You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Wisconsin's elections this week were officially nonpartisan. If you've been listening to WPR, you've heard about 5 trillion times that means that candidates don't run under a party label, like Democrat or Republican or the rest. But you may have noticed subtle signs that there's some partisan political involvement, like massive donations or ad campaigns from the state Democratic and Republican parties and from major donors on the left and right, directly to candidates, to parties, or to outside groups that support candidates. A lot of that money went into the campaign for Supreme Court, but many school board races around the state saw endorsements, donations, and advertising from groups with partisan ties. So what's the deal with nonpartisan races in Wisconsin? Are they less nonpartisan than they used to be? Does it matter if they are? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the heavy political angle in the state Supreme Court race? Would you like to see political parties and big donors on the left and right stay out of those kind of races? And how about school board? Did you have a politically charged campaign in your district? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mordecai Lee has been watching Wisconsin politics for a few years now. He's an emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Rob. Glad to be here.
Now, before we get into the nonpartisan part of this discussion, we were just talking on the show about the importance of that Supreme Court outcome. Just want to get your thoughts on that before we get into our main topic.
Well, I guess it's all about power. And up to now, power in the Supreme Court was sort of invisible because of the very topic that you introduced. That's that we elected Supreme Court justices on a nonpartisan basis. So it was harder for the voters to figure out who's the right-leaning candidate and who's the left-leaning candidate. And the breakthrough, whether it was a good precedent or a bad precedent in the race on Tuesday, was that we really easily could identify who was the left-leaning and who was the right-leaning candidate. I think there's a certain advantage to helping voters find the team that they want to vote for. I suppose the analogy would be, you know, what if at a Packer game at Lambeau Field, both teams wore the same uniform? How would we know who the Packers were and who the Bears were? So maybe the advantage of partisan elections versus nonpartisan elections is, I'm fill in the blank. I'm right-leaning. I'm conservative. Now I know who to vote for because that person's identified as Republican or, you know, on the other side. So maybe it is a service to the voters to do that. You'd have to go back to history. It's almost naive to think about the good government movement in Wisconsin about 100, 120 years ago under the La Follettes, where, you know, the theme was, let's take politics out of, and then fill in the blank, out of the spring elections, out of school board races, out of mayor's races, out of county board races. And the line they used to use in those days was, there isn't a Republican way to pick up garbage or a Democratic way to pick up garbage. There's only an efficient way to do it and a corrupt way to do it. And that really was the underlying logic of more than 100 years ago to have nonpartisan races.
Now, with a judge, say, in the Supreme Court, we could envision, and I think this is an ideal, the really impartial judge who takes the law and the precedent and the history and applies it to this issue without concern for the outcome and who it's going to make happy or make angry. Has that ever been the case? Is it naive to think that that could be a thing that we would want?
We were probably somewhat naive. Going back to when I started following Wisconsin politics in the 1960s, generally speaking, if you knew enough about the candidates and their backgrounds, you could sort of tell who was the de facto Republican and who was the de facto Democrat. But it was very, almost invisible. It was very hard to tell. I think the reason that a Supreme Court race is different from, let's say, a trial level court, circuit court, or the appeals level court, is that if you're a trial level judge or an appeals level judge, your job is to interpret the law and apply it as it's written. The famous line is, all you're doing is you're calling balls and strikes. Mm-hmm. You're not imposing your own personal views. Now, when it comes to the Supreme Court, they do get to impose their personal views because they're the ones who set precedent. They're the ones who interpret the law and decide what is the basis for making a decision? And that's where people started falling to the left or to the right. I think it was easier for us to see it on the U.S. Supreme Court when we knew that somebody who was nominated by a Democratic president was likely to be left of center, somebody named by a Republican president was likely to be right of center. And so we saw the Warren Court that sort of tipped to the left, and then we saw other courts that tipped to the right. And now it's really sort of infected Wisconsin Supreme Court politics, and even at lower levels. For those of your viewers who aren't in the Milwaukee area, we have had a Court of Appeals race, and the incumbent judge who had been named by Scott Walker was opposed by an opponent who sort of literally, almost literally said, he was named by Scott Walker, and I disagree with that. And she just killed him, almost a 2-to-1 vote, because in Milwaukee County, it's so Democratic dominated. So it's a trend. It's probably a bad trend, but it does help the voters in the long run.
I've been doing a mental exercise. Suppose somebody wanted to run for state Supreme Court as a moderate, as a down the middle, you know, old school, whatever you want to call it. I'm going to call balls and strikes. Who would they get money from? Like, where is there's not a motivated money group out there or donor or things like that that feels excited enough to give money to that versus, oh, somebody I agree with on my side, whether that's right or left. Is it impossible to have that kind of candidate be successful?
Oh, you've really hit the nail on the head, Rob. Just to play out your example, nobody would give to them except their relatives and their cousins and maybe their next door neighbors. And, you know, they'd have about $53 to spend versus the kind of millions that we saw. I suppose, based on what you just said, I think that's an argument for public financing of elections. Now, generally speaking, the taxpayers hate the idea that their tax dollars would go into politics. But if you think about it, what if the only way you could run for a state Supreme Court would be to be eligible for public financing of elections? You couldn't spend your own money. You couldn't spend anybody else's money. You were capped by the amount of money you got from the state. And your opponent was equally capped by the amount they got from the state. That would move us in the direction of what you described, but it I'm afraid it's sort of a fantasy. It's never going to happen.
We're talking about nonpartisan elections in Wisconsin, like the ones we just had, and why there seems to be a lot of partisan involvement in them these days. Issues, money, especially from state Supreme Court down to your local school board. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. David is with us in Delavan. David, hi.
I got to grab this. Hello, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, David?
What I wanted to bring up basically is how this is, you know, this Supreme Court justice being elected is celebrated as this, you know, it's going to obviously overturn the abortion ban. And they're, you know, this is a celebration of women's rights. I, for one, am pro-choice. I see this as a dark day in Wisconsin.
Did you mean to say pro-life? If you think it's a dark day, you said pro-choice, but I think you might have meant pro-life.
I'm pro-life.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, pro-life. And I don't know. I think, you know, so we just went through this season, Black Lives Matter, what happened in Kenosha and all this kind of stuff. Well, Planned Parenthood was founded by Margaret Thatcher, who, of course, was a racist person. And there is genocide that is taking place, you know, today, basically at the hands of these abortion clinics, with the vast number of aborted babies are African-American.
David, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Mordecai, David, obviously not happy with the outcome. Margaret Sanger, I think David meant. But I want to take that to Janet Protasiewicz. Went closer to the line, it seems like, in expressing her views on the issue that David raises, abortion, than we usually see, at least publicly, in these Supreme Court races.
There's no doubt that she was much more explicit about the position she took on some very hot issues, including, and in particular, abortion. But I'd like to suggest that in the previous races, some of the candidates had inched closer to the line, never as close as Protasiewicz did. But, you know, they would hint, well, I'm generally conservative or I'm generally progressive. And they would sort of leave little hints and innuendos that people could interpret who was the conservative candidate and who was the liberal candidate. So she made it much more explicit. But I think we've really had that same thing to a lighter degree in Wisconsin Supreme Court races for at least 20 years.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mordecai Lee, emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker, looking at nonpartisan elections in Wisconsin, like the one we just had, why they feel pretty partisan these days. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Talked a lot about the state Supreme Court. We're also going to get into school boards and want to hear a report from your part of the state. If you saw heated political school board elections where it seemed like, even though they didn't have D's and R's by their name, there were Democratic and Republican candidates. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Mordecai Lee, emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee, longtime observer of Wisconsin politics. We're talking about officially nonpartisan races in Wisconsin elections. We've been talking about the state Supreme Court, but there's also school boards and local government and why there's so much partisan involvement in them. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So school boards, especially in rural districts, it's hard to get people to even run for a school board. And if you bring partisanship into it, it makes it even more difficult. In a small little burb of Lodi, the Columbia County Democrats decided to get involved in the election, basically endorsed two candidates, provided help for them. They had meetings inviting these candidates to them to provide support. They kicked out members of the public who were not Democrats. Do we really want this at a school board level where all kids should feel welcome? And is that a way to get more funding to schools when referendums are needed to have that much division? Doesn't make sense to me.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Lodi not alone. Mordecai, we saw lots of political involvement from the Democratic Party, in some cases Republican Party, and highly funded outside groups. What are you looking at there?
You know, I think something has changed. It's almost like the old model of nonpartisan school board races just absolutely cracked during COVID. In other words, up to COVID, there was sort of this general mainstream feeling that there was something called a good education, a quality education versus a lousy education or a bad school board or a micromanaging school board. And that Democrats, people who are generally Democrats and generally Republicans, just did not focus on any partisan issues. They focused on people they thought were competent and qualified and hardworking, just exactly the way Steve was describing the old model. But then all of a sudden comes along COVID, and should the school close or not close? If it's open, should they have to wear masks or not have to wear masks? And it was like from 0 to 100, it's almost like it happened overnight, that school boards got just totally swamped by parents and citizens on both sides of those issues. And suddenly school board meetings seemed like, I don't know, a state legislative meeting, you know, where people yelling and screaming at each other. And the poor school board members were just sort of hit by this tsunami of opinion. I don't know how to get back to where we were. And Steve is right. We want, these are thankless jobs. You spend night after night in meetings and reading documents in advance and making judgments if the superintendent is doing a good job or a bad job, if you need to increase taxes or not. Those are tough issues without partisanship. I'm just not sure how to get back to the good old days.
Steve, thanks for the call. And Mordecai, I've been wondering, we hear a lot about local issues being overwhelmed by national issues. We're all voting based on what we're hearing in national news and national websites. There's less local media to follow those local issues. Is that part of what's driving this? We're picking our side in national politics and writing that onto the school board level?
Well, there's no doubt that over the last 10 or 15 years that local news media, mainstream news media at the local level, you know, the local daily, the local weekly, the local radio station with a news staff, that all that has gradually faded under the pressure of financial success or bankruptcy. And so I think you're right, Rob, to hint that maybe it's been replaced by sort of national news. And both parties have really succeeded in identifying issues that can be transplanted from one state to another. For example, I think the Republicans have been very successful at creating issues such as parental rights or criticizing issues of trans students. Whether one agrees with what comes out of this right-leaning ideology or not, it's very successfully transported across municipal lines, across state lines, because an issue of, let's say, parental rights or trans rights or teaching about slavery or not teaching about slavery, those are applicable throughout the country.
Talking to Mordecai Lee, Emeritus Professor at UW-Milwaukee, looking at nonpartisan elections in Wisconsin where candidates don't run as a Republican or Democrat, say, and this goes from state Supreme Court to the school boards we've been talking about, and why there's a lot of partisan angles to them these days. I've got more callers looking at the judicial elections here. Let's go back to our callers with Cindy in Green Bay. Cindy, hi.
Hi. I would just like to say that, you know, I think everybody's partisan, but when it comes to a judge or a school board member, we should be able to expect that they are big enough to set that partisanship aside and, as far as judges go, do what's right by the law. As far as school board goes, do what's right for the children and the school and not their party. And that's part of the problem. But I think it stems from the top. And we've seen it now with the Supreme Court. They're making it partisan. It's transferring down everywhere. I just think that's how it's going to be from now on until maybe we as the people say enough is enough.
Cindy, thanks a lot for that call. She phrased that in an interesting way, Mordecai, the idea that, okay, yeah, maybe they do have a partisan lean, but when they take that position as a judge or a school board member, you know, they might lean in a certain direction, but they will be able to evaluate the law or the facts facing a school board in an objective way. I mean, that doesn't seem impossible, does it?
You know, Rob, maybe the best example is when the state Supreme Court had to make a decision about drop boxes, whether it was legal under state law for municipalities to put out drop boxes, you know, with all the security, 24-hour cameras and all that, whether it was permitted under the law. And there were two ways to interpret the silence of the law. There was nothing in the state laws that either banned drop boxes or permitted drop boxes. So the state Supreme Court justices really had to make a kind of ideological decision. A conservative approach was, if it's not explicitly permitted by the law, then it's not permitted. Whereas the sort of the right-leaning liberal justices could lean in the other direction. If it's not prohibited by state law, then it's permitted. How do you break that deadlock? How do you bring a decision that that somehow transcends those perceptions of how to make a decision? So I think it went in one direction, and maybe under a new justice, it'll go in exactly the opposite direction.
Thanks for that call, Cindy. Now, a cynical observer, Mordecai, would hear your story and say, yeah, that wasn't a reflection of their judicial thoughts on the presence or absence of a law. It was their thoughts on an outcome. One Dropbox outcome might benefit Republicans more than Democrats. The other way around. Is that fair?
You know, I think, Rob, the reason why that might be an applicable example as a predictable decision by the conservative and liberal justices is that the 4-3 vote by the conservative majority, with the exceptions of just a few cases by one Justice Hagedorn, have become so routine and so predictable and so by rote that we can only interpret that as meaning that they have a very set political ideology. And in a sense, the facts be darned, they're going to do what their partisan oriented thinking would go. And so it's 4-3, 4-3, 4-3. And now after August 1st, when she takes office, it's going to be 3-4, 3-4, 3-4. So the majority may have flipped, but the underlying predictability, I fear, has not.
Some states, have elections for state Supreme Court justices that are not nonpartisan. You run as a Republican or a Democrat for the court, or you go, I think there's one state where you go from a Republican primary, a Democratic primary, and then magically become nonpartisan. But would it be, I don't know, more honest? Would it make sense, do you think, Mordecai, for Wisconsin to switch to that system? You're an R, you're a D, you're running against each other.
You know, given these partisan times, I think maybe we should junk nonpartisan elections. Maybe we may as well do what the de facto election on Tuesday was, and that's that it was a partisan election, liberals versus conservatives. And, you know, maybe just one quick historical example. The first time that in Milwaukee, about 100 years ago, they elected a socialist mayor, it was because mayors in Milwaukee at the time were elected on a partisan basis. And the Democrats and Republicans in the state legislature didn't like that. So they united to make mayoral races nonpartisan so that it'd be harder for the voters to figure out who was the socialist. And so there was an example of sort of the major two parties thinking they would benefit by having nonpartisan elections instead of partisan ones. So it can go in either direction based on the historical momentum.
Mordecai, always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Mordecai Lee, emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. He joined us for a look at partisan politics in Wisconsin's officially nonpartisan election races, like the ones we voted in earlier this week. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Senate voted to end the authorization for the use of military force in Iraq from 20 years ago, which will have to go through the House and the president to become law. We'll find out what that would mean if it's repealed, the impact it's had over the last two decades. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A Wisconsin chef shares advice on making a great fish fry at home. You can join in with your questions and suggestions. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll weigh the shifting balance of political power in Wisconsin and find out what impact the state Supreme Court election could have on some major issues in the state. First, we're in the third week of spring, and migratory birds are coming back to Wisconsin. Many birds, like red-winged blackbirds and waterfowl, are already back. There are many more to expect as it gets warmer in the next few months. We're talking about spring birding in Wisconsin, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What birds have you been spotting? Which ones are you looking forward to? What are your favorite birds to see this time of year? Do you have a favorite place to go? Whether it's your backyard, a state park, you name it, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stanley Temple is a professor emeritus of forest and wildlife ecology and environmental studies at UW-Madison, and he's a bird expert. Stan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
I'm excited, Stan, and I'll tell you why. Following the advice of some other guests over the last year, I've at the bus stop, I don't pull out my phone. I stand there and I look around for birds. And that's been really boring because all I see is house sparrows. If I'm lucky, a crow or maybe a gull flying up high. My viewing is about to expand a lot, right?
You're right. April and May are the time for spring migrants to arrive.
Excellent. And which ones are already here that we might already be getting an eye on here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think you mentioned a couple of red-winged blackbirds come back in February. Actually, so do our sandhill cranes. And sandhill cranes are now pretty ubiquitous around the state and very noisy as they're establishing their territories. So most people are aware that they've returned. Killdeers are back. A lot of the earliest arriving birds actually do come back in late February.
Now, what divides the birds that are coming back to Wisconsin to stay and nest over the summer versus the ones that, you know, Wisconsin's just sort of flyover, stopover country for them?
Well, it all depends, of course, where they're targeting for breeding. And for Wisconsin, we actually do have a lot of the birds that we see during April and May are going to settle somewhere in the state to breed. But there are others that are headed much further north, that are headed up to the boreal forests of Canada or even to the high Arctic. So the birds that are headed for the boreal forest, some of the familiar birds might be things like white-throated sparrows that often turn up at bird feeders, broad-winged hawks, and quite a few warblers. And for the birds that are headed to the Arctic, tundra swans have already started coming through, lots of waterfowl species, And most of the shorebirds that pass through Wisconsin are actually headed for the Arctic.
I want to give a listen to some birds that we can watch out for. We've got some bird calls here. First, the house wren. All right, I've heard that sound. Stan, I don't know if I could pick a house wren out of a lineup, but tell us about the house wren.
Well, house wrens are fairly familiar to people because they often nest in the nest boxes that we put out in our yard. And they are just about to arrive. Mid-April is a good time to see them. And they're coming to us mostly from southeast, from wintering in the southeast U.S. And they said they're very familiar because for most of us, if you put out a box in your yard, wrens are almost certain to find it. So they're a very familiar bird.
And now we'll give a listen to the eastern phoebe. Okay, I get a familiar sound. Tell us about the eastern phoebe, Stan.
Yeah, eastern phoebes are also fairly familiar because they often nest under the eaves of our house if we've got some decent habitat around our house. So again, they're familiar birds, and they've already arrived. They came in early April. And sort of like the house wrens, they've spent the winter in southeastern U.S. and are just arriving now.
Talking to Stan Temple from UW-Madison, it is spring. It is bird migration season. We're figuring out what to watch out for this time of year and in the month or so to come. You could join in at 800-642-1234 to report your sightings or what you're looking forward to. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Bruce is with us in Kenosha County. Bruce, hi.
Hi, I'm calling from Kenosha County. I live on a lake down here, and the last few years, during their migration, the pelicans stop in. We have about 100 pelicans in this flock that's been hanging out at our lake for a couple of days.
Have they shown up yet this year, Bruce?
Yeah, we've been watching them for the last couple of days. I haven't seen them feeding this year, but that's fun to watch them feed.
Fantastic. That's an amazing bird to see, especially with quantities of them, Bruce, right?
Yeah, it's like 100 of them, and they come sailing in all in formation, right? And then they just kind of cruise around the lake in a big group, and they rejoin each other and split up, and it's fun to watch.
Bruce, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know if people think of Wisconsin, Stan, as a pelican state. I have seen them, not in the numbers that Bruce has, though.
Well, they're a fairly recent addition to the state. They traditionally, historically, bred further west. But certainly over the last 20 or 30 years, they've been moving east and are now, well, as Bruce said, fairly common in some places around Wisconsin. They've just arrived again from spending the winter down in the southeast U.S. And at least one explanation for the increase in numbers and their spread eastward has been the expansion of fish farming in the southeast U.S., which gives them an abundant supply of food over the winter.
Bruce, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Stan, is it common for birds to change their migration patterns over time, start to show up in places like Wisconsin where maybe they didn't used to?
Well, it does happen. And of course, we're seeing some fairly rapid changes in the migration behavior of quite a few birds in response to climate change. Mm-hmm. So the schedules on which many of the short-distance migrants, the birds that are basically spending the winter somewhere in the U.S., those short-distance migrants are arriving much earlier than they did in the past as our winters get shorter and spring comes earlier. So people have probably noticed things like robins, for example, are arriving very early in the year, sometimes almost 2 to 3 weeks earlier than they did in the past.
Stan, I know a big issue for various migratory birds over the years has been habitat preservation, availability of the kind of stopovers that birds need. Have we done a decent job in more recent decades of making sure that our key migratory birds have what they need?
Well, in the past, we did a very strategic job of providing stopover places for migrant waterfowl, primarily through the National Wildlife Refuge System. And it's more recently that we started to worry about stopover habitat for some of the other migratory birds. So yes, indeed, it is important. The difficulty, though, for many of our migratory birds is it's difficult to predict when and where they're going to have to settle during migration. That is often determined by the immediate weather conditions. So the strategy for providing habitat, stopover habitat for most migrant birds is to have a good diversity of habitats across the landscape rather than having specific places on the map.
Let's go back to our callers. Carrie is with us in Horicon Marsh. Carrie, are you at the marsh right now?
I'm in Horicon, yes.
What did you want to tell us about?
I joined the conversation a little late, but I just wanted to talk about the birds we see in the watery fields right by our house. There were hundreds of swans this year, many types of ducks, pelicans, of course. But this year I saw something I hadn't seen before, and I don't know if this is something that's been around the last couple of years and I just didn't notice. It's called the white-fronted goose.
The white-fronted goose, Carrie. Thanks for that, Stan. Is that somebody we usually see, Stan?
Well, white-fronted geese do turn up in migration in Wisconsin, but not that common. Not nearly as common, for example, as Canada geese. But yeah, they do turn up occasionally. And like many of the birds that you just talked about, the tundra swans and many of the waterfowl species that you're seeing there, are probably heading for breeding areas much further north of Wisconsin. So the tundra swans, of course, their name kind of gives it away. They're headed for the Arctic tundra.
Carrie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Carrie mentioned Horicon and the Horicon Marsh there. Stan, how important is that marsh and other wetlands in Wisconsin for our birds, especially the migratory ones?
Well, Horicon, of course, is a state and federal wildlife refuge, and it was specifically created to provide habitat for water birds. And Horicon, of course, not only provides good stopover habitat for many species, but it also, of course, is breeding habitat for many. So as a very large, extensive, well-managed wetland, Horicon is a very important wetland. In fact, is already designated as a wetland of international importance.
We're talking about spring bird watching with Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We want to hear about your springtime bird sightings. What have you seen in your neck of the woods so far? Where do you go? Do you go hiking to see birds in particular environments? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about migratory birds and spring birdwatching season. Stan Temple is with us, Professor Emeritus of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What birds are showing up in your yard, your neighborhood? Who are you looking forward to? What questions do you have for our guest about migratory birds, their habitats, their habits here in Wisconsin? The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Want to get back to some of our bird calls? Here's a listen to another one. Okay, Stan, I'm not great at identifying bird calls, but even I know that one's the whippoorwill. Can you talk about the whippoorwill?
Yeah, whippoorwill is a very distinctive call and, of course, associated with more rural wooded parts of Wisconsin. They'll be arriving in late April, and they have come a fair ways. They've come from the southern U.S. and as far away as Central America, and they are very consistent about their arrival dates. So they are pretty precise about arriving in that last week in April.
Are there other birds that have that kind of timing precision?
Well, most of the long distance migrants, the ones that are spending the winter in Central America and South America, are much more precise from year to year about the timing of their migration. because they are using photo period, they're using day length as their key sort of migration clock. And that doesn't change, of course, from year to year. And they can basically time their migrations very precisely. The short distance migrants, some of the birds that we've already been talking about, of course, that winter in the U.S., experience North American temperature. So they often are varying quite a bit from year to year based on whether it's an early warm spring or a late cold spring.
We heard from Willem in Colfax who wanted to ask about merlins. Are they rare, he asks, or are they still around?
Ah, merlins, a favorite species of mine. I did my master's thesis studying merlins. Merlins have increased phenomenally since the pesticide era and have greatly expanded their range into mostly the northern half of Wisconsin. But they are now becoming, you know, not an uncommon bird across the upper Midwest. And some of the birds have actually wintered with us, especially in urban areas where they are very fond of dining on house sparrows and some of the other common urban birds.
The pesticide story, when I think of the DDT era, I think mostly of bald eagles in particular. They have clearly made a comeback since that era. What other birds were hit hard then that maybe have done better since we banned DDT?
Well, we've got a bunch of them in Wisconsin. Peregrine falcons, of course, are back and nesting in quite a few places, including just yesterday, the pair that nests here in Madison laid their first egg of the year. Ospreys have increased tremendously and, again, are now nesting within sight of the Capitol. But probably for many people, the bird that is a surprising backyard bird in most urban areas of Wisconsin is the Cooper's hawk that was really decimated by pesticides and has come back strong and found backyard bird feeders to be a very easy pickings for meals on small birds.
And speaking of backyard feeders, if we want to feed birds, or I guess the birds that eat the birds that feed on the feeder, what kind of things do you see as most helpful for birds that might need that little assist if their habitat isn't all it could be?
Well, if we focus on the migrants that are just starting to arrive, there are things you can do. We've mentioned birds like house wrens. So clean out the nest boxes and make sure they're ready for occupancy. Keeping your bird feeders going, and especially for some of the specialists like Baltimore Orioles and ruby-throated hummingbirds, put out the oriole feeders and hummingbird feeders in time. For almost all of our migrants, keep your bird bath full, because most of the birds that are migrating overnight come down, land in the morning, they're exhausted, they're dehydrated, and are anxious to find something to drink. And of course, this time of year, those birds are tired when they land, and they are easy victims for cats. So perhaps especially this time of year, keep your cat indoors. There are things that you can do in your community. Wisconsin has a wonderful program called Bird City Wisconsin that encourages communities to do things that provide habitat and other conditions that help birds. And of course, we all are probably aware that many birds meet their end during migration by running into lighted structures like buildings. So in your community, you can encourage owners of tall buildings to shut their lights off at night.
Talking to Stanley Temple, Professor Emeritus of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, a bird expert, talking about spring migration season, the exciting birds showing up in Wisconsin now and in the weeks to come. Still time for you to join in with your sightings, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I want to give a listen to one more audio clip here. We've got the gray catbird. Okay, that's kind of a fun little sound. Tell us about the gray catbird.
Well, they are a fairly long-distance migrant, and they're going to be arriving in late April with that very distinctive sort of mewing call, and they've come from as far away as Central America, where they spend the winter. So like many of the long distance migrants, they tend to be fairly precise about the time when they migrate and arrive in Wisconsin.
Now, Stan, over the years, we've talked about threats to bird species. You've done work on the passenger pigeon, for example, no longer with us. Where do you look with concern now at our modern bird species? What are some of your greatest areas of worry?
Well, that gets pretty diverse because there are so many real threats to birds these days. The principal one, of course, is habitat, the fact that human beings are destroying and altering the habitat that bird species need. We know that a disturbing proportion of the birds of the world, as well as birds in the state of Wisconsin, are suffering declines because of habitat loss. In many cases, it's things that are often not happening necessarily in Wisconsin, but things that can be affecting the birds while they're on migration or on their wintering grounds. We know that there are other things that we have done a pretty good job of taking care of. We mentioned earlier the pesticide era when many of the top predatory birds really suffered as a result of contamination of their food chain. And that's a problem that we have more or less solved. And it's not as much of a threat to birds as it used to be. So the main focus really now is this sort of race against time to protect and manage habitat that will accommodate these birds, both on the wintering grounds while they're migrating and on the breeding grounds.
On a happier note, you mentioned earlier sandhill cranes. I've already seen some this season. You know, my wife grew up in Wisconsin, talked about, you know, that was something you didn't see. And now we see them. That seems like a pretty good success story. Stan, do you think that example might be an inspiration for other success stories for other species?
Well, for some species, it can be. The sandhill crane is an example of a species that benefited from the very first federal protection for wildlife, and that was the Migratory Bird Treaty of 1918, just celebrated the centenary. It protected birds from direct killing, and sandhill cranes across the Midwest became rare and just about disappeared from the upper Midwest for the fairly simple reason that we were killing them. And for sandhill cranes, they have a very low reproductive rate, so it took them a long time to recover. But by the 1970s and 1980s, the population reached its stride and has been increasing rapidly ever since. So that Wisconsin is pretty well saturated with sandhill cranes now, and the additional birds that we're producing in Wisconsin are spreading out into surrounding Midwestern states. So we're actually sort of a source for birds recovering in other areas.
And in just our last few minutes, Stan, you've seen a lot of birds. You've studied a lot of birds. Is there something that you are excited when you get that rare glimpse here in Wisconsin?
Well, birds of prey are always my favorite. So I'm always very excited to see birds of prey doing their thing, being predators and showing off their mastery of the air and their wonderful ability to do things in the air that we often think are not really possible. Peregrine falcons perhaps come to mind for being the fastest birds on wing and just dramatic birds to watch. And fortunately now in Wisconsin, there are literally dozens of places where peregrine falcons are nesting, where one can easily watch them. Many of the nest sites have nest cameras on them so that if you want to tune in online, you can sort of eavesdrop on what the birds are doing.
Stan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome, Rob.
That's Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at spring bird watching in Wisconsin. You can keep sharing your sightings on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, the shifting balance of political power here in Wisconsin after this week's elections. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.